U.S., Israeli, and Hamas negotiators are said to be closing in on a deal to release some of the hostages in exchange for a humanitarian pause in fighting.
Well, there have been reports now for a few days that they were getting closer and closer, and apparently the deal is that Hamas will release 50 hostages, 10 at a time, each 10 over each 24-hour period.
A new poll from Network NBC says President Joe Biden's approval rating has declined to its lowest level of his presidency.
Well, it is true that his numbers have dropped to the lowest they've been.
And former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, known as the closest advisor to Jimmy Carter, during his one term as U.S. president, has died at the age of 96. Today is Monday, November 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Kim Lewis. U.S., Israeli, and Hamas negotiators are said to be closing in on a deal to release some of the hostages in exchange for a humanitarian pause in fighting. And 31 very sick newborn babies in incubators have been evacuated from Shifa Hospital, which the World Health Organization says has stopped functioning as a medical facility and is now a death zone. VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about these and other Israel-Hamas war-related events.
U.S., Israeli, and Hamas negotiators are said to be closing in on a deal to release some of the hostages taken during the October 7th terror attack in exchange for a pause in fighting. But along the way, some sticking points have arisen. What has been going on regarding these negotiations?
Well, there have been reports now for a few days that they were getting closer and closer. And apparently the deal is that Hamas will release 50 hostages, 10 at a time, each 10 over each 24-hour period, and Israel will pause the fighting for 5 days. Originally, Israel only wanted to pause the fighting for 3 days, feeling that 5 days might give Hamas time to rearm. During that 5 days as well, more humanitarian aid would get into the Gaza Strip. You know, there are all kinds of reports, but again, until it actually happens, it's not clear that it will go through.
I understand 31 very sick premature babies have now been evacuated from Shifa Hospital.
Yes, the Palestine Red Crescent Society evacuated these babies who were premature infants, and they will be eventually taken to Egypt for treatment. By the way, Israel has released footage that it says shows an extensive tunnel network under the Shifa Hospital, which is what Israel has been saying all along and has been saying that's the reason that they went into the hospital. Israel also says that a 19-year-old Israeli soldier whose body was found a couple of days ago was actually killed inside the hospital. And they released footage showing Hamas gunmen bringing a Thai worker, a Thai hostage, and another hostage into the hospital.
And the World Health Organization has said Shifa, of course, one of Gaza's main hospitals, has stopped functioning as a medical facility, and they're now calling it a death zone.
Yes, the World Health Organization paid a brief visit to Shifa Hospital for about an hour. And the truth is that there are very few people left. There are several hundred very sick patients and some medical staff, and everybody else has left. And as you said earlier, these babies have been transferred. But basically, Shifa became a war zone. I mean, Israel has taken over the whole area, and there's been heavy fighting in that area. And apparently, there are also quite a few bodies at Shifa of Hamas gunmen. So I think what the World Health Organization was saying and is that the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is growing. And that's the idea, is that if there was a 5-day ceasefire, that the international community would be able to get much larger quantities of aid into southern Gaza, which is where the vast majority of Gaza's population of 2.3 million Palestinians is at the moment.
There seems to be a lot of news concerning action in the periphery of the Israeli-Hamas war. For example, we've heard about Hezbollah in Lebanon, and now we're reading that Yemen's Houthis are saying to take control of an Israeli-owned ship in the southern Red Sea.
That's correct, although it doesn't seem to be an Israeli-owned ship. Yemen did take over a ship, but it's not an Israeli-owned, as far as at least what Israel is saying. And there were no passengers on board, just the crew. And so, yes, it does seem to be spreading to other areas. In terms of Hezbollah and the Lebanese border, there's actually been quite a bit of fighting. Israel says that at least 100 Hezbollah gunmen have been killed, either shooting at Israel or planning to shoot at Israel. That said, it's still short of a full front war. Israel says it is prepared to fight on two fronts. That said, they have warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, warned Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, that Israel will destroy Beirut if Hezbollah really steps up the fighting.
That was Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein talking with VOA's Rick Pantaleo. A new poll from the news network NBC says President Joe Biden's approval rating has declined to its lowest level of his presidency, 40%, as strong majorities of all voters disapprove of his handling of foreign policy and the Israel-Hamas war. For more insight on this poll, I spoke with John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
Well, it is true that his numbers have dropped to the lowest they've been. They have been low overall, so they've not dropped dramatically. They're not in a very good position for an incumbent president. But we do have the new factor of follow-on to the attacks on Israel, where president has strong support overall, even some reasonable support from Republicans. But he has a portion of his base that is worried about his support and perhaps is more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. So it's a question of, first of all, a president who generally has some popularity problems. And then secondly, a president whether he can hold together his base in the coming election in the fall of 2024.
Yes, that's a really good point, because the election is about 11 months away. And so what would he need to do to improve his poll numbers? Or is this not a big concern for the Biden administration at this point?
Well, I think it's a concern. The president does not want to be at 40% approval rating. That's generally too low to be able to win an election. But you have seen other presidents be able to, over time, especially as the campaign goes, and there's a choice between Biden and perhaps former President Trump, where people make that contrast. So I certainly think the administration should be worried. They would like to get those numbers up. They are not numbers that have never been seen before and that could not be changed. So it means basically that they have some work to do in the next year. And ultimately, making that case, especially if it's a choice between this president and the former president, is a key thing for them to do.
Yes, and as you pointed out, the poll finds President Biden behind former President Donald Trump for the first time in a hypothetical general election matchup. Is this unusual, or is this something that could change over the months?
Well, I think we're seeing similar numbers to what we've been seeing, close numbers between President Biden and former President Trump. So that's not a sign that this is going to be a runaway election, but it's also not a sign that it's one that he's going to lose. So it's a close election, it looks like, a long time away. He's in a lower position than he'd like to be, but not one that's unheard of. And I guess we have a long campaign to go where the president will need to make some improvements. But at this point, it looks like a tight competitive race between the two parties.
And also, the new survey showed a shift among voters ages 18 to 34. Now, in September, 46% of these voters said they approved of Biden's job performance, but it dropped to 31% among these voters in this new poll. Is it due to Biden's foreign policy and the Israel-Hamas war, the way it is being handled?
I think the most immediate change is due to that. Certainly, President Biden has often found that he did get the vote of the younger voters, as do Democratic presidents in general, but that there has been some weakness in that view, in that those voters, some of them tend to be more progressive and think the president might not be on the same page with them. But it's still unclear whether they really believe that at the end of the day they would vote for the other party, for the Republican Party. So it is a sign that there is some softness in the progressive younger voters who are not as enthusiastic about Joe Biden, both about his Israel policy, but also about other things.
That was John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We are also following these other stories from around the world. The Finnish border guard says dozens of migrants stood behind barriers Saturday at two crossings on Finland's border with Russia after Helsinki erected barricades to halt a flow of asylum seekers it says was instigated by Moscow. The Kremlin denies this assertion. Voters in Argentina headed to the polls Sunday in a presidential runoff election that will determine whether South America's second largest economy will take a rightward shift. Populist Javier Milei, who started as a television talking head, has frequently been compared to former U.S. President Donald Trump. He faces Economy Minister Sergio Massa of the Peronist Party, which has been a leading force in Argentine politics for decades. Gale force winds and heavy rain and snow have hit large parts of Bulgaria, claiming the lives of two people, causing severe damage and disrupting the power supply in towns and villages. Residents in eastern Bulgaria, which was hit hardest by the storm, said they had never experienced such weather. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has died at the age of 96. VOA's Kane Farabaugh, who extensively covered Rosalynn Carter's life and post-White House career promoting global health and democracy with her husband, former President Jimmy Carter, has more.
Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter acknowledged the secret to her nearly 80-year-long marriage to President Jimmy Carter was space and respect.
We grew to respect each other. I respect what he could do. He would respect what I could do. And from then on, it's just been a really wonderful partnership.
Eleanor Rosalynn Smith Carter was born in Plains, Georgia on August 18, 1927, and lived in the small peanut farming town during the Great Depression.
I had a really wonderful childhood until I was 13 when my daddy died, and that was sad. But we were poor, but everybody else was poor. We didn't even know we were poor because we had food in the garden and we had a cow in the backyard with milk and mother made all my clothes.
She grew up familiar with the son of a local peanut farmer, James Earl Carter Jr., better known as Jimmy.
When he was 16, for instance, a senior in high school, I was 13, his little sister's friend. I never ever dreamed I'd go with him.
But on a visit back to Plains in 1946, while attending the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, Jimmy Carter proposed.
When I asked Rosalynn to marry me the first time, she said no. That was in February, and it wasn't until May that she changed her mind and decided to get married.
They married in Plains on July 7th, 1946. Mrs. Carter followed her husband during his naval career and gave birth to three sons, John Jack Carter, James Earl Carter III, or Chip, and Jeff. Daughter Amy was born later in 1967. The family returned to Plains in 1953 to take over the Carter peanut farming business, which Mrs. Carter managed even after her husband decided to enter politics in 1962.
But he got up one morning, and instead of putting on his khakis to go to work at the farm supply business, he put on his Sunday pants. And I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to see who's going to run for the state senate."
After contesting the results of that election, Carter won, launching his political career that eventually carried them into Georgia's governor's mansion in 1970 and the White House in 1977. While campaigning to help get her husband elected, Mrs. Carter heard a similar concern from voters.
Every single day that I campaigned, I had somebody ask me what I would do for a mentally ill loved one.
As First Lady of the United States, Carter used her platform to advocate for mental health, forming a presidential commission to address the issue. She traveled the world the rest of her life, working to remove the stigma associated with those suffering from mental illness.
Everybody in our country can realize that it's just an illness like any other illness.
President Carter encouraged his wife's prominent role in his administration and sought her counsel throughout his tenure, including during the Camp David Accords, which ended a state of war between Israel and Egypt.
It was one of the most exciting, I think, thrilling days of my life. And I was standing with Mrs. Begin. Prime Minister Begin got to her before Jimmy got to me. And he came up and he said, "Mama, we're going to go down in history for this."
The hostage crisis in Iran contributed to Carter's presidential election defeat to Republican Ronald Reagan in 1980. And the couple returned to Plains, Georgia in 1981 to plan their post-presidential life, which Jimmy Carter told her he wanted to be different.
I have an idea about what we can do with the rest of our lives. He said we can have a place kind of like Camp David where we can negotiate a peace agreement. So that was the germ of the idea for the Carter Center.
Founded in 1982, the Carter Center today is one of the leading global nonprofit organizations working to wage peace, fight disease, and build hope to underserved populations throughout the world. Under Rosalynn and Jimmy Carter's leadership, the Carter Center has monitored more than 100 elections, treated millions of people suffering neglected tropical diseases, and is on the verge of total eradication of guinea worm. It also gave Rosalynn Carter the means to continue her work in mental health advocacy globally.
That's what I wish for, that people go for help and get help and lead good lives.
Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter are the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history.
And my life's been an adventure.
As her husband entered hospice care toward the end of his life, the Carter family announced the former First Lady was suffering from dementia. She spent her final years alongside Jimmy Carter in the small town of Plains, where they were born and grew up nearly a century before. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
Australian Immigration Minister Andrew Giles says 93 foreigners released from indefinite detention will be forced to comply with strict visa conditions starting Saturday. The country's high court this month ruled it was unlawful to hold people in immigration detention indefinitely. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia's High Court ruled November 8 that people couldn't be held indefinitely in immigration detention. In response, the country's Labour government has rushed new laws through federal parliament that now force released detainees to adhere to strict visa restrictions, including wearing electronic monitoring devices. Individuals must provide authorities with information about whom they live with, travel plans, associations with clubs or other organisations, and personal financial details. Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs Minister Andrew Giles told local media the measures were designed to keep the community safe. Documents filed by government lawyers to the court showed that the 93 people released from indefinite detention after the ruling included about 20 detainees arrested in Australia over concerns about national security and cybercrime, while others were members of serious and high-profile organized criminal gangs. 27 other detainees had been convicted in Australia of very serious violent offences, crimes against children, or violent sexual or exploitative offences against women. The High Court case involved a stateless Rohingya man who faced possible lifelong detention in Australia because no country would admit him because of an Australian conviction for child sexual offences. The government had insisted his detention was lawful because it planned to expel him, but hadn't been able to send him to another country. Rights groups have criticised the new detainee monitoring laws. Josephine Langbian, the acting managing lawyer of the Human Rights Law Centre, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Friday the legislation is overly restrictive.
It's a regime that is going to subject this particular group of people to harsher restrictions and harsher penalties than anyone else in similar circumstances in the Australian community. The majority of people in this situation are people who can't be returned to their country of origin because either they are stateless or they're at risk of serious persecution.
Australia, however, claims the new surveillance measures are lawful and proportionate. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
Leaders of the union representing Hollywood actors announced a tentative deal recently with film and television studios to end a strike that started in July. It includes pay raises, streaming bonuses for actors, and the industry's first protections against the use of artificial intelligence. From Los Angeles, Genia Dulu has our story.
After more than 3 months on the picket lines, Hollywood actors recently reached a tentative deal with entertainment studios to end their strike. Central to the actors' strike have been compensation guidelines around the use of artificial intelligence. The proposed agreement includes protections for actors regarding the use of digital replicas of their image, says Duncan Crabtree Ireland, chief negotiator for the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
It can't just be a boilerplate sentence that says, I give away the rights to use this replica in perpetuity throughout the universe, et cetera, et cetera. It has to be a specific description of what the intended use is so that the performer can make an informed decision about whether they want to agree to that or not.
Union leaders say the proposal includes guidelines for the use of generative artificial intelligence to create so-called synthetic performers.
We have a provision that requires the companies to get the consent of performers whose facial features are used as part of the creation of such a synthetic, even if it's more than one performer, even if it's only a part of those recognizable facial features.
One question that remains is who controls copyrights to digital replicas of performers after their death, says Hollywood talent agent Tiana Jackson.
And it said that if you died, if they could not find the executor of your estate, essentially, then the union would become that executor and they would have that ability to make that decision as to whether or not that AI could be used. And I fundamentally disagree with that.
Actors have started voting on whether to ratify the labor agreement ahead of an early December deadline. Jenny Adulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Kim Lewis.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Back in 1962, President John F. Kennedy noted that the United States and Ecuador are involved in one of the great adventures in the history of this hemisphere, and indeed the history of the human race and growth. Kennedy was referring to the task of building a more democratic and more progressive future for everyone living in the Western Hemisphere, said USAID Administrator Samantha Power.
For decades, USAID has worked alongside the people of Ecuador to build schools, to build highways, water, and sanitation systems, to conserve millions of hectares of precious biodiversity, to improve child and maternal health, to build stronger democratic institutions.
During her visit to Ecuador in early November, Administrator Power identified the three main priorities of the people there. At the top of the list is security. It's why USAID launched Polaris, a $17.7 million program to bring together government officials, civil society organizations, and community leaders who are working to reduce crime throughout Ecuador, said Administrator Power.
Already, Polaris has helped 9 municipalities work with their citizens to develop and implement comprehensive strategies to reduce crime. That means not just better policing, but building more secure communities through installing community alarms, better lighting, activating neighborhood councils, improving ways for citizens to access information on security and on self-protection that can help keep them safe.
Second, there is a need for leaders at all levels of government to be able to meet the needs of all their people, especially historically marginalized communities, said Samantha Power. USAID's new Tu Municipio Responde program, or TUMUNI for short, will do just that. Help local governments respond to citizens' needs by expanding access to water and sanitation and other public services. Finally, there is a need to expand economic opportunity for the most marginalized communities, said Administrator Power. So, USAID formed a new public-private partnership with Ecuador's leading supermarket chain, La Favorita.
This public-private partnership is going to provide small-scale farmers with the technical assistance, the training, and the access to finance that they need to grow quality produce at the scale that is needed and at the quality that is needed to meet Corporación Favorita's sourcing requirements.
I believe, said Administrator Power, that we are still on what President Kennedy called that long great adventure to build a more secure, more prosperous, more democratic future for all the people of this region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.